ground. Any object below the ground that has any difference in electrostatic characteristic, if it's got any difference in dielectric constant, conductivity, if it's got any change in characteristic compared to uniform soil, a rock, a piece of metal, a bullet, whatever, any object that is different in propagation is going to give you an echo. Let me drop them. In the case of a normal radar operating in air, normal targets are a metallic object like an airplane. You get a great big echo off of it. If I built my airplane out of wood, and you and I say to yourself, hey, the wood is non-conductive. I've got this shellacked piece of wood and a whole lot of slats of it, and I've made an airplane out of it. Maybe it's a model airplane. The fact that the airplane has a dielectric constant that is different than the air around it means I'm going to get an echo. The echo I get off my wooden airplane is going to be a hell of a lot weaker than I would from a metallic airplane. But it's still a disturbance of Mother Nature's free space. That radio signal, when it's propagating in free space, in order to keep going forward in a uniform manner, it wants to see nothing but 377 ohms per square, free space, normal impedance. You put anything in that free space that has higher or lower dielectric constant, higher or lower permeability, higher or lower conductivity. You put anything in that free space that looks different than free space, you're going to get an echo off of it. The only thing we have to discuss is how strong is the echo, and is your radar receiver sensitive enough to see it. So that ground-penetrating radar, the signal is falling off in signal strength real fast because of the conductivity. You're getting a kind of skin effect, but the skin effect of dirt is a hell of a lot bigger than the skin effect of a copper piece of tubing. So the signal's getting real weak, real fast, but ground-penetrating radar, properly designed, you can probably look at echoes quite a number of feet below the surface. And as long as that object below the surface has any difference in characteristic of conductivity, dielectric constant, permeability, permittivity, if it's different in any property at all, you're going to get an echo off of it. And if your receiver is properly tuned,
repeater, time out.
If your receiver is properly tuned in the time domain as well as the frequency domain and sensitive enough, you're going to see that echo and you're going to say, hey, I see that body below the surface. It might be a human being that's buried there. And could you, with a ground penetrating radar, find a human being in a grave? Absolutely. So maybe that's some of the answer the person is looking for, Rich, on KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. So I assume if you want to know how deep something is buried, you look at the time delay of the receiver activity, and that will tell you, once you're familiar with the penetration of the particular dirt, you should be able to determine the depth. Is that how they do that?
You got it, John. When it comes to the velocity of propagation, the velocity factor of your coax cable, it's 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant. So if I build my coaxial cable where the center conductor is insulated in air, I get very close to the speed of light. If it's if my cable is made out of polyethylene for the dielectric material, then because of the dielectric material and polyethylene, the dielectric constant is something like 2.5. 1 over that is, the square root of that comes out to be 66%. So polyethylene cable, like RG8U, the signal penetrates through the cable, it propagates down the cable at 66% of the speed of light. Make the dielectric material Teflon, and you get 70% of the speed of light, and so on. Okay, dirt has a velocity factor, I don't know what it is, but it might be 70%, 60%. So you know the velocity factor of the dirt, which is a function, by the way, of how much moisture is in the dirt. As the dirt gets wetter, the dielectric constant goes up, the velocity factor goes down, and therefore you get more microseconds, more nanoseconds per foot. But once you've calibrated your system for the way your dirt is behaving today, Each nanosecond of delay on that radar screen represents some number of feet. So an object buried 3 feet down, the signal has to go down 3 feet, come back 3 feet, 6 feet in that round trip, plus the air gap. It's going to be at least 6 nanoseconds, probably 10 nanoseconds delay. So 10 nanoseconds of delay on your radar display might represent an object that's 3 feet down. So distance is time. Once you figure out the speed of the radio wave in that medium, and that medium of
repeater, time out.
That medium has a certain dielectric kind. Using it as a ground-based object, looking at objects in the air, like aircraft, and you're looking at half mile, 10 miles, 100 miles, you're looking at some number of miles, and depending on the design of the radar, you might have a range resolution of 1,000 feet, tenth of a mile, whatever. In other words, as the aircraft that you're looking at on your radar scope moves 1,000 feet, a mile, 2 miles, you can easily detect the difference on that scope. So a typical radar might have a range resolution of a small fraction of a mile, and a typical distance that might go out to 10 miles, 50 miles, 100 miles. I've looked at radars that went out more than 300 miles beyond Earth curvature and looked at signals out there. On a couple of sunny afternoons in August, I can remember the L-band radar at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, which is usually operating at least 8 hours a day because of all the experiments they were doing. Every so often you would get a super refraction phenomenon. Let me drop it. Where the signal that's way beyond the horizon is being bent such that the signal is following Earth curvature. And the whole east coast of the United States, Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, and sometimes down in North Carolina, we would see all of that displayed on the radar screen when you set it at the maximum range. So radars typically have ranges of a good number of miles and range resolution of a fraction of a mile. Okay? That's a typical radar. I decided to take the radar concept and push it to the living limit in the experiment that I had to do at the Benningfield Anechoic Facility, the great big antenna range at Edwards Air Force Base. It's a 300-foot square range, 7 stories high, inside of a 100 dB tempest-proof room. In other words, this antenna testing range is a screen room with 100 dB or more of shielding from outside world to inside world. And the thing is, what, a half an acre of property, ground floor, 7 stories high. So you put a whole B-1 bomber in there, for instance, and make measurements. And they were getting extraneous echoes in that chamber. They couldn't find out where the echoes were coming from. They knew they were getting a whole lot of extraneous echoes. And they had spent 6 months trying to find out what was going on. I decided to design a radar that had a range resolution of a quarter of a foot, 3 inches. I could look at that chamber 3 inches at a time and find every echoing device in that chamber every 3 inches. So if somebody dropped a nail or an adapter into that anechoic foam, into the material on the floor, I could find that object by building a radar that had that range resolution. The radar that I constructed,
Krant repeater, timeout.
Your typical radar, let me drop it. Your typical radar puts out a burst of RF energy that's somewhere between 1 and 20 microseconds long is the burst of RF energy. Then the transmitter turns off, and the receiver looks for the next milliseconds as to looking at all those echoes. 6 microseconds per mile. So if you're looking at 100 miles, I guess you're getting 600 microseconds of total delay. So by looking at microseconds of delay and converting into miles in how far that target is away, I was building a radar that was not 1 to 10 microseconds of pulse duration, not 1 to 10 nanoseconds of pulse duration. The pulses I was generating were a quarter of a nanosecond long, 250 picoseconds, at 10 gigahertz. Each individual pulse consisted of 3 cycles at 10 gigahertz. It transmitted 3 cycles and turned off, and then we looked for the echoes. And the echoes I was looking for were only a few nanoseconds downrange, because the whole darn chamber, when testing it from the center, only went 150 feet in any one direction. So 150 nanoseconds out and 150 nanoseconds back. In other words, the wall, which is the maximum range that I cared about, was 300 nanoseconds away, a third of a microsecond away. So this is a very unusual radar. And by the way, it transmitted 1 million pulses per second. Each individual pulse was a quarter of a nanosecond long. Sounds very complicated. Once you understand the principles of how a doubly balanced mixer works, you can generate pulses that brief with a very fancy Avtec. This little guy in Canada named Avtec built these video pulse generators that would put out a pulse that was a small fraction of a nanosecond long. Let me drop a call. So that was the video pulse generator that turned on an RF device called a doubly balanced mixer, and it made RF pulses a quarter of a nanosecond long, and the resulting radar allowed me to look into that chamber with a quarter of a foot of range resolution. You talk to a normal radar person with normal experience, and you describe these numbers. From his point of view, it's out of sight. This is a very special radar for a very special application. And it found all the echoes in that room once we set up that radar. And it, before that technique was applied, they had spent 6 months looking for all the echoes in the room. There were so many of them, they couldn't find out where the hell they were coming from. It turns out the wooden structures in the room that were supporting the test equipment was one of the great big echo effects. Somebody had naively assumed that a piece of wood wouldn't give you an echo. Well, a piece of wood has got a dielectric constant of 4. It gives you an echo that's only a few dB weaker than a chunk of steel at the same size. That's the way radar works. That radio signal, when it goes into air, it wants to see nothing but 377 ohms per square. If there's any change in the characteristic of that air, you put a piece of plastic, a piece of wood, you put anything in that air, you're going to get an echo. The echo might be very weak, but if you've got a sensitive enough radar, if there's anything changed other than air, you're going to get an echo. And so that was the principle of operation. When I first proposed to do that, the normal people with normal radar experience said, Dick, you're crazy. No one's ever done it that way. You can't do that. To which I said, well, why not? Let me drop the phone. And the first thing they told me is, you can't even build a detector that can see a pulse that fast. A crystal detector that takes your RF energy and gives you a video pulse out of it, it can't respond much faster than 3 nanoseconds. And you're building pulses that are only a quarter of a nanosecond long, and you want to be able to see the individual details of that quarter nanosecond pulse. Your crystal detector can't do that. To which I said, you're absolutely right. I'm not going to use a crystal detector. I'm going to use a sampling oscilloscope, and I'm not going to detect the signal. I'm going to look at the RF energy of that pulse directly on a sampling oscilloscope. Worked like a charm. Over to you, John. So, as you can tell, the word radar is an extremely broadband word. The kinds of radars that are in the world, boy, there's a zillion of them. There are radars that are agile in pulse rep rate, agile in pulse duration, agile in frequency, agile in the modulation within the pulse, and so on. Radars that are fast, slow, long, high, strong, weak, and so on. The echo device, the acoustic echo device that allows you to look at the inside of a human being. I can't even think of the name of that machine, but it is a kind of a radar. So you can do radar at acoustic frequencies, you can do it at RF frequencies, you can do it at any frequencies. And so, in the case of the imaging inside of a human being, let me drop. That is an ultrasonic radar, which is detecting things in fractions of a nanosecond in order to see an inch at a time or a centimeter at a time as to what's going on inside of your body. So, radar is a really magic word, and my goodness, are there various crazy kinds of radar. You haven't heard the end of that story yet. The person who designs a radar these days for the electromagnetic, for the electronic countermeasures world, the guy designing the radar has got the advantage. The guy who's designing a radar jammer, he's got the disadvantage, because that radar designer, if he's using all of the tricks in his bag of tricks nowadays, he can build a radar that is so agile. I call it an agile radar. In other words, each individual pulse is different in frequency, different in pulse duration, different in pulse modulation, different in pulse rep rate, and you try to build a jammer for that thing, it's difficult. Not impossible, but you're at a huge disadvantage. because that radar designer has got so many knobs on his test panel, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, KQRIW in the tech band.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
A couple of other radars, you know, they have very clear images of Venus, but yet you can't see down below clouds. So what they've done is, on a spaceship, they've satellite that they put up there years ago called Magellan. They used all radar to see what was below those clouds. And I think it was 80 meters or something, somewhere in that area. I'd have to double check. They have another one, I believe, on the same frequencies attached to Cassini, going around Saturn, and they could look below the clouds of the moon, Titan, and, you know, they use them all the time on the satellites going around Mars. But you don't want to confuse it. Like you said before, there's different types of radar. They have one mounted on the rover, the Curiosity rover. And I believe that's called Dan. And that looks 1 meter below the surface. I know John wanted to know about the depth. 1 meter below the surface, looking for signs of water. And that's using something different. That's using neutrons. Back to you, Dick.
The Arecibo dish, the 1,000-foot diameter dish in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, has been used as a radar to look at the surface of Venus. You get a somewhat fuzzy picture, but you do get a picture of Venus. The signal going to Venus and coming back comes back something like 3 or 4 minutes later. Does that mean each individual pulse is going to be 3 or 4 minutes, by the way, 3 or 4 minutes one way, so that's a 6 or 8 minutes round trip? Does that mean you're only going to transmit one pulse for 8 minutes? Not at all. You transmit as many pulses as you want, but you've got to do something to identify the individual pulses to know that you're looking at the pulse number 10,000 downrange when you're looking at that first echo. But that's a radar that's looking at the 93 million miles is the distance between Earth and Sun. So at the time you're looking at Venus, Venus might be 30 million miles away. Round trip to Venus and back might be numbers like 8 minutes, numbers like 6 minutes. And you can build a radar, if you're smart enough, that can resolve individual details on Venus from a 30 million mile distance. Boy, there are all kinds of radars. To put a satellite in orbit around Venus is going to give you a much better picture. But you can still get a picture from 30 million miles away if you've got an antenna that's big enough, you've got a transmitter that's powerful enough, and you've got a receiver that's stealthy enough. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Look out for those radars. Some of them are really potent.
KC2WGB. Well, I guess we have competition with the, how many antennas are there? 5 grand? Okay. How many radars are there? Have they surpassed antennas, or are they about the same? What do you think, Dick?
The total number of radars in the world is millions. The total number of types of radars, I think, is smaller than the number of antennas, because the best radar in the world is useless if you don't connect it to a radar antenna. So if there was 5,000 kinds of antennas, I'd like to believe there's less than 5,000 kinds of radars. But there's a big number. I'm going to guess this. There could easily be 1,000 kinds of radars if you look at all the possible frequencies, all the possible polarizations, pulse durations, pulse rep rates, agilities. And by the way, the word frequency, the word radar, it doesn't have to be an RF frequency. It can be an optical frequency, an ultraviolet frequency, an infrared frequency, a millimeter wave frequency, a microwave frequency, an HF frequency, an acoustic frequency, and so on. Looked at properly, all of these can be radars. So an ultrasound, that's the word I'm looking for. An ultrasound really is a one megacycle acoustic radar that's looking at the organs inside of your body. It is a radar. And it's got a phased array transmitter and receiver. That's how it gets the right angular resolution in order to detect the individual, to detect the shape of the individual organs inside of your body. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, it makes sense. You can't have more radars than there are antennas to support it, so they might be even, but the style of radar could be quite vast. All right. Very good. Let me let it drop. I'll go on to my last one. Okay. N2HUH has a question that he wanted to ask you about antenna. All right. Vertical and horizontal at 160 meters. He has read, and he's wondering your opinion whether this is correct or not. I don't believe it is, but he said that at 160, the style of antenna, let's take a dipole, that is being used, only the main energy transmission is only like maybe 30% of that antenna. So he wants to know, having the antenna straight and perfectly set up for the first 30% and then zigzag the rest of it, does that make any sense? And is there any way, and he's speaking about vertical and, because you know he's running a butternut, I think, whether it is vertically done or a horizontal antenna like in a simple dipole. He's wondering about that. Is that the reason why you can run the wire for a certain length and then zigzag it all over? Or is that not happening in his estimation? What do you think, Dick?
If this was the best of all worlds, when you're down at 160 meters, the top band, some people call it, the top band in wavelengths. I mean, here your wavelength, a half-wave dipole on 160 meters, a full half-wave dipole, would be something like 260 feet long. And so a quarter-wave dipole would be 130 feet high. And very few of us have got a structure in our backyard that starts at the ground and goes up 132 feet to be a quarter-wave monopole-like antenna. The directivity, the pattern, the antenna pattern you get out of an antenna is primarily a function of how many wavelengths is the antenna. When it comes to impedance matching and making a good antenna as a radiator, the infinitesimal dipole chapter of the Bible, that's the book by John Krause, W-H-A-K, called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, that was the first edition. And he's got a second and a third edition. Let me drop it. But you look at the Brown and Woodward curves, you look at the infinitesimal dipole section of Krause's book, you'll discover that as you make the antenna half wave, quarter wave, eighth wave, 16th wave, 32nd wave, the antenna has a defined impedance. And if you're smart enough in designing the right kind of an impedance matching network, an antenna tuner, so to speak, you can make the infinitesimal dipole tune, resonate, and radiate 95% of all the energy you put into it. That's the good news. No matter how small the antenna is, to make it a good radiator is easy. Well, in the case of 160 meters, a quarter wave like ground plane, maybe you're only making it an eighth wave or 16th wave, but it's a ground plane antenna, you do have to put down some pretty substantial ground plane radials. And if you decide to build the antenna as a half-wave radiator, and I'm talking about half-wave electronically, mechanically, not at all. I mean, for you and I to build a 132-foot, let me think, half-wave radiator, yes, it's 260 feet. To build a radiator that's 260 feet long, to be a half-wave on 160 meters, if you did that, you wouldn't have to put down ground plane radials. That's if it's made full length, half wave, radiator, 260 feet. Not many of us can do that and have the bottom end of it insulated from ground. Let me drop it. You take that 260-foot long vertical half-wave radiator, and now you use loading coils, top hat capacitors, zigzag, helical winding. You use all of the tricks in the book. You can make that 260-foot thing 30 feet long instead and resonate it at 160 meters. When you go from the full half wave, 260 feet, down to 30 feet with your shrinking techniques, the efficiency of the antenna will change very little. The gain of the antenna will change less than half a dB if you make it out of lossless materials. So there's no change in gain, no change in efficiency, almost no change in pattern. The fact that you shrunk it down, and the fact that the portion of the radiator you're looking at now is zigzag, helical wound, top hat capacitors, and might be great big zigzags. You think you're going to get an antenna pattern that's very complicated out of it? Not at all. As long as the end-to-end dimension of the antenna is half wavelength or less, you don't have the resources to generate anything but a very simple donut pattern. To make an antenna pattern in three-dimensional space that's more complicated than a donut pattern, let me drop it. The laws of physics of interferometry dictate that you must have substantially more than a half wavelength of dimension tip to tip in order to have the resources to make a more complicated antenna pattern. If the number of wavelengths of your antenna, the radiator, is less than a half wave, you don't have to worry about how it's physically located, how it zigzags and whatever. You're still going to get that antenna pattern very similar to a donut. It has no choice. So don't worry about the antenna pattern. If the majority of the antenna is vertical, you're vertically polarized. The fact that you zigzagged a whole lot of it horizontal, but each of those zigzags is an extremely small fraction of a wavelength, you're not developing any substantial amount of horizontal polarization. The majority of the resonance is vertical, you'll be vertically polarized. So you're worrying about the fine details. And that radio wave, when you're way below a wavelength, it can't have any different pattern. Let me drop it. The antenna you squeeze into your cell phone is so darn small compared to the wavelengths. It has a very close to omnidirectional pattern. When you put it into a SATAMO machine, a machine that will make a three-dimensional antenna pattern plot of your cell phone, almost every one of those patterns looks like an apple because the high gain areas, they color it red, and the lower gain areas, they color it some other color. It looks like an apple, and you're going to have a little bit of a null in a couple of directions. That's where the stem of the apple is. So that cell phone antenna inside of your cell phone, it's so small in wavelengths, it's got a very close to omnidirectional pattern. Same thing about your 160-meter antenna that you shrunk in size. So an antenna at 900 megacycles, that's a quarter wavelength long, and a 160-meter antenna, that's a quarter wavelength long or shorter physical wavelength. Electronically, you can make it a half wave if you want to. But if it's physically less than a quarter wave, it's got a very simple antenna pattern. It has no choice. There are people who would like to take tiny little antennas. In other words, I'd like to be able to make a Yagi where each of the elements are a tenth of a wavelength long. And I'd like to develop the same pattern as an ordinary Yagi. And the boom length is only a half wavelength long. I can dream about that. The laws of physics won't let me do that. I'm going to get an omnidirectional pattern. I've made a very elaborate structure. It doesn't matter. The only way you get... Let me drop it. The only way you get anything more than a very simple donut-like pattern, you must have real estate. Wavelengths of real estate. Without those wavelengths, you're not developing an antenna pattern. You're radiating almost isotropically. That's physics. can fight that as much as you want. There's very little success in that fight, if you know what I mean. There's a lot more to the story, but maybe that helps, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can you hear me over that, Dick?
Yes, I can. It sounds like somebody is trying to talk to us, but he's talking into the wrong microphone. We're just hearing his little bit of echo from the room is what it sounds like. Over to you, John.
Yeah, I thought it was Barry. That voice sounded familiar, but okay. But Andy's another part of that question that he's looking for, and I'll make it simple. The entire length of the antenna, no matter how it's set up, as long as it's tuned properly, that antenna is radiating equally across the full length of the antenna. There's no reason to think that only 30% of it is radiating or 20% of it is radiating. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're about to time out, I think. That sounds like a broadcast station is coming through.
Okay, it could be somebody fooling around.
You're absolutely right there, John. Assume that the whole antenna is radiating. There might be a little more radiation coming from the high current section versus the low current section, but the whole damn antenna is radiating. And whether all of it's radiating or only 10% of it is radiating almost doesn't matter. The whole antenna radiating is going to give you this very broad donut-like pattern because you've got so few wavelengths, you can't develop any more directivity pattern than that. And so even if 30% of it's radiating and 70% of it's not radiating, if you want to be extreme, it doesn't matter. If the whole thing radiates, you've got a very broad pattern. If there's only a little bit of it is radiating, let me drop. I think we're not coming out of 375. Oh, yes, now I am. Okay. If the whole darn thing is radiating, you're getting a broad pattern. If only a small section of it is radiating, you think you're getting a more broad pattern. Once you're down to an omnidirectional pattern, you can't get any more broad than that. An omnidirectional antenna is the lowest antenna gain in the world that still has 100% efficiency. So we're getting into academic conditions here. So pattern-wise, it wouldn't matter if only 30% of it's radiating. If the antenna isn't multiple wavelengths long, it has no significant antenna pattern. It's almost omnidirectional. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I'm sure that'll help Andy with his question. And if not, he'll probably come on the TechNet or maybe send me another email. But very good. Let's go over to Paul. That's it from the mailbag. And always a pleasure. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Yeah, we got to worry about whether or not right now I'm listening to 375 and okay. Yeah, my signal is not coming out of 375 right now. K2RIW. Testing. Not coming out of 375. Something is locking up the system.
I hear 375 now, Dick.
I'm hearing my signal coming. coming out of 85. I'm not hearing my signal come out of 375 right now, Paul. But let's go on to the space report. WS2N, about to give a space report number 227 of the series. You got it, Paul. What's NASA doing today, KGYIW?
Okay, very good. Well, all right, I'll deal with the situation. I'm used to timing things out anyway. That won't be anything new. Well, a lot of things going on. The launch of a Soyuz next week, actually this week on Thursday, will be going up with another American astronaut, Peggy Whiteson. This will be a third flight up there. So that's the American component of the Soyuz launch. So they'll be doing that there. They have a European astronaut and a Russian commander will be flying the MS-3 spacecraft up there. The reason it's number three is because it's been redesigned, and it's the third flight of this new Soyuz redesigned spacecraft. So we'll look forward to that on Thursday, and it's going to be a 3:20 p.m. launch. So I'll watch that on NASA TV. That's always nice to watch. I hope all goes well. We have an American up there now, and you know he's got two Russians with him. Let me drop it.
I'm going to guess, Paul, that we could make believe that MS stands for Modified Soyuz Number 3. Three astronauts are going up. I think you're saying one American astronaut is up there now and two Soviets. So does that mean the total number on board is going to go to five or six people? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, KGYIW.
At EMS, I always considered a manned Soyuz. And they've had other different numbers and different variations, but you know they changed it a little bit this time. Y'all now have six people after they go up: two Americans, two Russians, and two European Space Agency astronauts. So that'll take off from Kazakhstan. Last flight just came back, what, a week or two ago. I talked about that on the net. That's the one that brought back astronaut Ruben, Sarah Ruben. So she's back and safe. But now you have a crew of three. And Kimbrough is up there, Shane Kimbrough, the American astronaut on board. And that's his second flight. Okay, so I always like to mention launches because as we go on, I'll wind up forgetting about that. The Falcon 9 situation, you know, that thing blew up September 1st. Looks like Elon Musk has a cause of that problem. He's been able to duplicate that effect out at McGregor, Texas. Let me drop it.
By the way, Paul, of the six astronauts that are going to be on board after this Soyuz launch, do we have a rough guess as to how many of them have a ham radio license? US2N, K2IW.
Yeah, Shane Kimbrough does, so he'll be using the ARIS system, the amateur radio, on board the International Space Station by the ARRL. There are always communication with NASA about that, so he'll be using that. Sarah Rubin did, and now Rubens, we say Rubin, it's Rubens with an S at the end. She came back, they all have five call letters because they get their license out in Texas where they're training at Johnson Space Center. And you'll find a lot of European Space Agency people, including the Japanese guy that came back with Ruben's last time. He has a 5 cool fine when he's training out in Houston. They also tell them, here, take this test. They're all geniuses, so they probably pass this thing 1, 2, 3, and they all get their technician license. So that's pretty much the way that goes. So that's 1, 2, definitely 2 of the Russians, so that's 4. Peggy Watson, when she's going up, I have a little problem. She had that ham radio last time. When I look her up, it's not coming up on QRZ, so I don't know if she dropped it or changed the call or something happened there. But we'll look into that. Let me drop it. And this is Expedition 50 and 51. And the next one after that, you also have a ham going up, Mark Vanderhei. He'll be here. They'll be up in the next spring. Also a ham license. It's fun when you look some of them up on QRZ. For instance, when I look up Rubens, looked up hers, and I was the 40th person to actually look up her caller. So, you know, they get their license, and if you dial it soon enough, you wind up seeing that these people have had their license very, very short time. So you mentioned Elon Musk. He'd like to start launching in December with the Falcon 9 again. We'll see. He thinks that the cryogenic system of loading oxygen and kerosene into the rocket might be going in too quick. He's done some testing where the kerosene actually gets so cold along with liquid oxygen. Liquid oxygen almost solidifies, brings it down to that temperature. Might be getting caught under the overwrapping of a helium tank, and it might be solidifying inside and expanding and contracting, causing a tank to explode. He's got 3 big tanks in there, and these helium tanks are about a meter high, half a meter wide, and he needs those tanks to pressurize the atmosphere inside the tank when the fuel is leaving.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And if it is, he'll be able to refly in December. Drop it. Now, let me just change topics for a second. I'm just wondering, I've been trying to what's going to happen now with a different administration in office. And I'm starting to suspect that, I know they're going to have a new national administrator. A couple of names already came up. But the old one is Baldwin. He was planning on leaving anyway, but he'll be replaced. And the people who actually charge NASA with the different missions that they can go on and how they fund it and all is really Congress. They have the different panels that are involved with NASA, and now that's all going to be changed. Goes to the administration, and I'm just starting to wonder what's going to happen. I'd like to see them keep the program that they have, but just add to it, but there might not be enough money. So who knows, that might change, and I wouldn't be surprised if they go back to manned flight to the moon. But I have a couple of theories of what might happen. A lot of climate change satellites that might be dropped. Let me drop it. You're saying so? I'm not hearing that open mic anymore. The bomb mission, I wouldn't be surprised if they cancel that, which is fine with me. I'm crazy about that one anyway. That's the asteroid redirect mission. Very expensive mission, and I don't know. I really didn't care about that one. I wouldn't be surprised if that one went away. But we'll see what happens. We'll give it time. I did watch a nice launch on Friday. WorldView satellite went up. Very high resolution satellite. Going to be taking pictures of the Earth. Private, all private. So neither administration couldn't care less about that, that's for sure. When it's private, they love it. And Atlas 5 took off with that satellite on board. Now, Atlas 5 is generally used for all NASA and government missions, you know, the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, launching spy satellites and all of this from Atlas 5 and Delta 4s, which is really a consortium of Boeing and Lockheed called ULA, United Launch Alliance. And they wound up getting a private contract, so that was good. It was a beautiful launch from California, from Vandenberg. And it got up there successfully. And it's a WorldView 4 satellite by Direct. Name of the company is Direct Global, I think it is. So they paid for the whole thing. So that's always good when they do that. Just a little hard to find a website that carries it. Because if it's private or a foreign flight, like India or something, then NASA doesn't carry it on their station. So they have to find it up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I knew that would happen sooner or later. One other thing is, this is talking about billionaires, Elon Musk, Trump, and there's this guy Milner, Yuri Milner, billionaire in Russia, and he backs a lot of these space programs, and now he's paying for different antennas to be pointed to space, and they're looking for alien civilization, so he's putting up a lot of money. One antenna that's already online is the one that you're familiar with, Green Bank, 250-foot dish, I forget the diameter, but that's the largest maneuverable antenna that, that exists. That thing's now on the payroll. Now they just signed up Parks, which I think the antenna is almost as big, and that's the one in Australia. Famous for first getting the TV reception from Apollo 11. And they also used Parks for making a movie called The Dish, a 2000 movie called The Dish. That was pretty good. So this guy's paying big money now, I don't know, a couple hundred million dollars for a year or two over a period of some amount of years. I forget how many years, but they'll be looking for aliens. Okay, I wrote it down here. 210-foot dish. And that's the one in Australia. Now, another series of launches that have gone up. This is why we have to keep doing our work with the space program. It's China. China has had three launches last week alone. Sometimes they go every 2 weeks or so, you'll see a launch. They had three different types of rockets. One rocket was a brand new rocket that they had never used before. Heavy lift rocket from a brand new satellite launch complex in China. And then there was another one a couple days ago. That was an interesting one, a science mission. It's got a couple of satellites on board, but one was very interesting. It's going to use pulsars. First time anybody has done this. Use pulsars, pick up their signals as a way to navigate through space. So let's see, one want to make a deep space mission to Mars or Jupiter or Saturn or someplace around Neptune, naturally you can't pick up the GPS satellites and drop it. So presently, all deep space missions, they have star trackers and they can, you know, these telescopes look at the different pattern of the stars and they're able to tell from that where they are. This system is going to use pulsars. They're going to test recording the X-band that comes off of the pulsars. I think 26 or 29 different pulsars. Experiment with that. Try to use them to orient their spacecraft. And if this works out in the future, they're thinking maybe, you know, 5-10 years down the road, they'll be able to actually use these pulsars for similar, you know, to the way we use GPS satellites. Just by picking up their X-band. You can't really test it on Earth near the satellite. X-band doesn't really get through the atmosphere too good. So that's a pretty cool mission. It's from China, so everybody thinks that the Chinese missions are all spy missions and this and that. No, they have a space station up there now with two guys on board, and they're doing some science missions. So that's good. Let me drop it. And I'm looking forward to launch. It's about a month away. It's a Cygnus mission. It's not the same Cygnus cargo mission they always talk about that leave Wallops Island or Florida to recycle into International Space Station. It's a different one. In fact, it's a different acronym. And that's it's going to be launched from the Pegasus rocket. Pegasus is a rocket that's built by Orbital ATK, and they'll be flying probably, I think, the third or fourth time out of Florida. Usually they fly out of California and launch from there. They've done like 40 or 50 missions from California, but this is going from Florida. And they go up in an L-1011 jet, a carrier jet, and they drop this Pegasus rocket, and on the front of it is going to be the Cygnus spacecraft. And essentially, it's really eight spacecraft in one. Each one only weighs like 50 or 100 pounds or something, very, very lightweight. But eight different ones. And the idea of that is to look at hurricanes. Let me drop it. And talking about radar earlier before, that's what this is. They send signals down. They receive signals from the whatever is hitting the wind. It'll hit the wind on in a hurricane and can come back up. And they have eight of these satellites flying together, and must be a complicated thing to design, but somehow it all collates together, and then they send the information back down to Earth, and they could tell the speed of the wind, I think something like 3 times a second, or some very, very, very fast timing. So I thought that was pretty amazing. I think we're going to see a lot less of that if they do start doing away with climatic satellites. There's probably 20 of them up there now that are active. You'll probably see a lot of money transferred from, I hope not canceled, but transferred from climatic observations to human flight. Back to you, Dick. There's always so much more. New rocket coming out by United Launch Alliance called the Vulcan, and there's another one coming out by Ariane Space called Ariane 6 instead of Ariane 5, and they've been funded, and the list goes on, Dick, K2RIW, WS2N, I'm getting long-winded.
Don't worry about being long-winded, Dunpole. Let me check you. Still on 375.